What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting, visiting Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and President Donald Trump Tuesday sought to smooth over bilateral disputes during a White House meeting. Mr. Trump emphasized their common goal in defeating terrorism.
We support Turkey in the first fight against terror and terror groups like ISIS and the PKK and ensure they have no safe quarter, the terror groups. We also appreciate Turkey's leadership in seeking an end to the horrific killing in Syria.
Mr. Trump also said the two countries are trying to reinvigorate trade and commercial ties. Through an interpreter, Mr. Erdogan described his visit as one that represents a historical turn of the tide.
The relations between Turkey and the United States have been erected upon common democratic values and common interests. Keeping our outstanding relations stronger than ever will be very important, not only for our common interests, but also stability of the globe and peace around the world.
Their talks took place just a week after the U.S. announced it intended to arm Syrian Kurdish militia in the fight to retake the Islamic State-held city of Raqqa. Ankara considers the militia, known as the YPG, a terrorist organization. Mr. Erdogan said such groups will never be accepted and have no future in the region. Mutinous soldiers in Ivory Coast have accepted a government proposal on unpaid bonuses and returned to their barracks Tuesday. Ivorian Defense Minister Alain Richard Donwahi said the agreement was reached peacefully and should be definitive. He said it needs to be implemented by all sides. The four-day uprising had closed businesses and schools and shut down roads, threatening the economy of the world's top cocoa producer. The West African country is still emerging from the chaos of a 2011 civil war. This is VOA News. As the latest round of Syrian peace talks got underway Tuesday in Geneva, Damascus denied U.S. allegations that it carried out mass killings at a military prison near Damascus and built a crematorium to hide the evidence. A Syrian TV presenter reading a foreign ministry statement described the U.S. report as full of lies and fabrications aimed at justifying a U.S. military intervention. Meanwhile, the U.S. imposed sanctions on several Syrian individuals and companies, citing relentless attacks on civilians. Iranian senior vice president Eshak Jahangiri, seen as a moderate, dropped out of the presidential race and threw his support Tuesday behind incumbent president Hassan Rouhani. Friday's election with four remaining candidates is seen mostly as a contest between Mr. Rouhani and hardliner Ibrahim Raisi. Indiana University analyst Hussein Benai said the prospect of a Raisi victory has energized a lot of voters.
Anytime an incumbent runs for re-election in Iran, their support is expected to dip, and I don't think that's going to be any different this time around, although we'll see in the last couple of days the prospect of Raisi really winning the presidency has forced a lot of people to kind of wake up from their slumber and publicly put their support behind Rouhani.
The election seemed as a referendum on the 2015 nuclear agreement, and the state of Iran's economy is Friday. White House National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster Tuesday defended President Trump's meeting with two high-ranking Russian officials this month and refuted a report by the Washington Post that Mr. Trump disclosed highly classified information about operations against Islamic State.
What the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged.
In a tweet Tuesday, Mr. Trump said he wanted to share with Russia facts pertaining to terrorism and airline flight safety so Moscow can step up its counterterror operations. Ukraine suspects that Russia retaliated for the decision by Kyiv to block Russia's social media networks and an internet search engine, as well as sanctions on Russian online businesses in response to ongoing separatist violence. Ukraine said Moscow is carrying out a cyber attack on the website of President Petro Poroshenko. No immediate report or comment from the Kremlin. Gunmen believed to be from Somalia's al-Shabaab militant group killed an administrative chief in his home in northeast Kenya. Police Tuesday said the attack occurred late Monday. The four attackers killed Dekau Abisirat in Mandera County near the Somalian border. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jack Kelly is expected to expand the current ban on large electronic devices on commercial aircraft and flights from several foreign airports. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's military is warned to stay out of politics amid rumors of a coup plan.
The Nigerian army is a political and a professional body that has clear constitutional duties and responsibility, and anything beyond or outside of that will not be tolerated.
Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Osman is the Nigerian Army spokesman. Amnesty International says an Ethiopian court terrorism verdict for a Facebook posting is a shameful affront to freedom of expression. At least four people were killed yesterday from renewed fighting in South Sudan's Yei River State. And rebel soldiers in Ivory Coast have ended their mutiny over bonus payments.
The mutiny seems to be over. I say seems to be over because we are not sure yet that everything is okay. But for the time being, the government, according to the agreement, has paid 5 million to each mutineer and will pay 2 million at the end of June.
Jean-Gervais Tchéide is a member of the opposition Ivorian Popular Front Party. The European Union bans Air Zimbabwe from flying its skies for failure to meet safety standards. And 250 students from around West Africa compete in robotics in Dakar. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's military is warned to stay out of politics amid rumors of a coup plan by junior officers. Chief of Army Staff Turkur Buratai says the Nigerian Army received information that some individuals have been approaching some army officers and soldiers for, quote, undisclosed political reasons. Rumors of a coup being planned by junior officers have intensified recently as President Muhammadu Buhari's health has dominated the news. Army spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Usman says the Nigerian Army is apolitical and professional and that anything beyond that will not be tolerated.
What really happened is that we had security information about some people, which we would not like to disclose for now, with regards to some issues that are unprofessional. And that is why we had to warn both parties, reminding them the Nigerian Army is a political and a professional body that has clear constitutional duties and responsibility. And anything beyond or outside of that will not be tolerated. And if any officer or soldier feel like involving himself or herself on issues outside the confines of his military duties or her military duties, he or she is advised to resign his commission or voluntarily put in paper to discharge from the army, then he or she can pursue their other endeavors beyond the military service.
So, Brigadier General, the information the military has that led to this warning, does it have to do with a possibility of some people planning a coup d'etat?
What I have just told you is that we have information. I cannot disclose beyond that. And those people involved, they know themselves. And we need to sound a word of warning to all those involved. And of course, to, you know, warn our officers and soldiers to desist and be conscious of their responsibilities as soldiers of the Nigerian Army.
So how credible is the information you have? Because we have information that the Army Chief of Staff has even informed the Vice President. So this must be serious.
If we don't have credible information, wouldn't have been coming out public to give the warning.
I know there have been some kind of uncertainty in your country because of the health of your president. Does the military believe some people are trying to take advantage of this?
Well, as you know, Nigerian Army is a professional and apolitical body that defer to constituted authority through the chain of command in the Federal Republic of Nigeria. So issues that had to do with such things is beyond the confine of the military. And that is why we are calling on officers and soldiers to be conscious of those constitutional responsibilities.
Nigeria, which has also new military takeover, has at the same time enjoyed 18 years so far of democracy. So if the chief of staff comes to make this warning, that means the military perhaps is what? In support of this democratic process in your country.
Exactly. That is what it's all about. You know, we always reiterate our loyalty to the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria and the democratic process in the country by equal stakeholders, and be rest assured the military is better off in a democratic government.
Was this behind the Army Chief of Staff reshuffling postings of some military generals last week? Because there was some reshuffling. Did this information that you have now have something to do with that?
Well, a lot of people tend to read meaning into every move or routine military activities in the country. But that is wrong. Postings and appointments are routine things. And if you look at the officers that were involved, they have stayed in their respective appointments for a considerable period of time that they need to, you know, be changed and let them face other appointments or endeavors. And some of them need to pursue, you know, other appointments that is relevant to their own careers. You have been in command for quite some time, there is need to go into staff appointment, or you've been in staff appointment, you need to go into command appointment.
Brigadier General Kukasheka, thank you very much for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
It is my pleasure, James. Thanks.
Brigadier General Sanin Kukasheka Usman is the Nigerian Army spokesman. You're speaking with me from Army headquarters in the capital, Abuja. Mutinous soldiers in Ivory Coast have ended their four-day rebellion over bonus payments after the government agreed to pay each soldier an initial amount of 5 million CFA francs, an equivalent of $8,400. The government also agreed to pay another 2 million francs at the end of next month. The rebel soldiers who fought to overthrow President Laurent Gbagbo have been demanding $20,000 each, which they say President Alassane Ouattara promised to pay them. Jean-Gervais Tchéide is the member of the opposition Ivorian Popular Front Party. He says the five cities that had been affected by the rebellion have begun to return to some normalcy.
The mutiny seems to be over. I say seems to be over because we are not sure yet that everything is okay. But for the time being, the government, according to the agreement, has paid 5 million to each mutineer and will pay 2 million at the end of June. So that will be the 7 million which they were claiming. Now, is everything over? I'm not so sure. Because those mutineers are mercenaries, and mercenaries never give up in terms of money. When you give them the money that you owe them, they go, and when the money is finished, they come back and tell you that you owe them more money again. So this will become a kind of permanent blackmail, and the government has started paying for the blackmail, and I'm afraid that they will have to pay again.
Well, you said that the mutinous soldiers agreed to accept 5 million. You mean 5 million CFA francs. This is probably an equivalent of $8,000. But that was the original amount that the government offered before. Why did they reject it, and why did they accept it now?
They rejected it because in the beginning, in January, the government agreed to pay 12 million to them. And to begin with, they paid them 5 million, and the agreement was that they should pay 1 million per month from February for 7 months. But apart from the 5 million paid in January, the government did not pay anything so far. That's why they no longer believe in anything that the government was saying. That's why they wanted to have the whole money or nothing. Yesterday, by 2 o'clock in the morning, the government signed the paper of the agreement to pay 5 million now and pay 2 million at the end of June. So they are satisfied. I guess that the mutineers are satisfied, and they withdraw and went back to the camps.
About 4 or 5 cities were affected. From your vantage point where you are in Abidjan, what do you notice in terms of some normalcy returning to the city?
Yes, I can confirm that especially tomorrow, everything will be quite normal. Today, it was, let's say, halfway, 50% of the activity have been resumed. But tomorrow will be okay. And I hear that the 5 cities in the country also are recovering the activities progressively. But tomorrow will be better. I can confirm that because I called some friends in the different cities which were concerned by the mutiny. They told me that everything was returning to normal.
You said the government promised to pay the balance, but this mutiny came about because the government did not fulfill its promise. Do you think now the mutinous soldiers have a reason to trust the government that they are not going to come back again to do another mutiny?
Well, this is what I fear. Because I think that there is no more trust between the government and the mutiny soldiers, because they were supposed to pay them each month 1 million, and they did not, until they came out again with a second mutineer. And when they came out with that mutineer, the government came out to say We pay nothing. $5 million, that's enough. We won't pay you anything again. And after the insistence and the firing gunfire for 4 days, now the government was obliged to give up their determination and pay the money, which means that this government will never do anything unless you lay pressure on them. And the mutineers have understood that. And I am afraid that next time they will do the same thing if their money does not come.
You've been very kind for the past 3 days informing us and bringing us up to date on the situation in Cote d'Ivoire. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Jean-Guevet Tchéhidé is a member of the opposition Ivorian Popular Front Party. He was speaking with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. Today is Wednesday, May 17th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Amnesty International says an Ethiopian court terrorism verdict for a Facebook posting is a shameful affront to freedom of expression. The court on Tuesday found former opposition spokesman Yonatan Tesfaye guilty of encouraging terrorism on social media. Tesfaye was arrested in December 2015 after he wrote on social media that the Ethiopian government used force against protesters. Save Magango is East African media manager for Amnesty International. He says the verdict is a miscarriage of justice.
First, we think it's a miscarriage of justice. We think it's a travesty that someone is found guilty of terrorism when all they did was to post some comments on Facebook.
Perhaps the government interpreted the comments as a threat to the government.
They would say that, but there is no justification for someone to be accused of terrorism or merely posting comments on Facebook. I think the authorities are overreaching, and they're overreaching by using the judiciary. They use the anti-terrorism proclamation, which is a law that is quite wide-ranging, it's vague, and it is totally unacceptable for people to be accused of terrorism simply because of comments that they post on Facebook. It is a calculated effort by the government to silence dissent in Ethiopia.
You know, we have an example of a similar case in Uganda where the university researcher there, Stella Nyanzi, was arrested because of what she posted. What do you make of what the judge in Ethiopia says that whatever was posted on Facebook exceeded the whole idea of freedom of expression?
I don't think you can put limits to people, to freedom of expression when people express themselves peacefully on Facebook. I think the example of Uganda is a different one. In Uganda, they did not charge anyone with terrorism. They charged them with an offense of misusing computers, but it was also disproportionate, and I don't think necessary, because this is freedom of expression. We see this happening from place to place. Governments trying to crack down on freedom of expression, especially online, by using laws such as anti-terrorism laws and other bad laws to justify cracking down. And at the end of the day, all they want to achieve is to make sure that no one criticizes them and to shut up dissenting voices.
As you know, the Ethiopian government has this, what I would say, notorious anti-terrorism laws. Just recently, or last year or so, the government imposed this state of emergency. Can the government argue that it's operating within the limits of the state of emergency in Ethiopia?
Well, the judge did not say that. So the background to this case is that this gentleman posted some remarks on Facebook during the heat of the protests in Oromia. And it wasn't at the time of the state of emergency. The state of emergency hadn't been imposed. So he's being judged solely for the comments that he put on Facebook. And those comments don't amount to incitement to terrorism as far as Amnesty International is concerned. He's been held in jail in December 2015 simply for expressing himself. As long as people express themselves and express themselves without inciting violence and calling people to rise up and to go harm others and all of that, it's not necessary and it's not really something that is conscionable for them to be accused of terrorism. It is not the only person who's behind bars under the terrorism proclamation. We see this happening from time to time. Every time someone tries to say something that the government deems to be critical, they end up being accused of violating the terrorism proclamation, which is quite broad and really, for all intents and purposes, a law that should not be on Ethiopia's law book.
Seif Magango is East Africa Media Manager for Amnesty International. He was speaking with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Eyewitnesses say at least four people, including soldiers, were killed and scores wounded when members of an armed group attacked government forces on the outskirts of the Ye River state capital, Ye Town, at dawn on Tuesday. State Governor David Lokonga says government forces repelled the attackers and the town is now calm. Daniel Friday reports from Ye Town.
Residents say they woke up to the sound of gunfire coming from the direction of Kegulu, some 6 miles west of Ye Town, along the road linking Ye to the Democratic Republic of Congo. They say the shooting took everyone by surprise because Ye has been relatively quiet in the past few months. Some residents first thought government soldiers were firing rounds to mark the 34th SPL anniversary, but knew it was more than celebration when the shooting continued for several hours. Eyewitnesses say the shooting spread to an area behind the teachers' training college, some 2 kilometers from Ye Town Center, as well as to the Sopiri area southwest of Ye Town. A resident who prefers to be identified as Data for security reasons says the shooting finally ended around 9.
I also heard gunshots all over Ye. People are all scared. I came out at around 9. I thought maybe we were already ambushed.
Ye River State Governor David Lokonga Moses blames rebels loyal to the former Vice President Riek Machar for carrying out the attack on government military base.
Enemies of peace at 4:30 a.m. in the morning deliberately attack the position of the SPLA, who are not ordered for any operations. The attack has caused a lot of panic to the entire masses of Ye River. We have 6 SPLA soldiers who are casualties of this attack. The doctors are taking care of them.
Eyewitnesses who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal say they counted 6 dead bodies, including those of soldiers. But Governor David Lokonga told reporters that he was yet to ascertain if any soldiers were killed in the attack.
Up to now, I'm waiting for the update of the place of the attack, if there are other cases who might have lost lives. I'm waiting for this one that will come. I would like to assure my people of Ye River State, especially in the town, the SPLA forces are in full pursuit of the attackers.
Lokonga says the situation has returned to normal and people should go about their normal business. Governor Lokonga urged Ye River residents to remain calm, reiterating that government forces are tracking down the attackers. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Ye.
The European Union on Tuesday added Air Zimbabwe to its list of airlines that are banned from flying over European skies. According to the Seattle Times newspaper, Air Zimbabwe planes do not meet EU safety standards. Other planes added to the blacklist include Nigeria's Medview. Zimbabwe airline owes creditors $300 million. Reacting to the ban, Zimbabwe's transport minister, Joram Gombo, said the EU informed airline management and the government officials in a meeting recently about its safety violations.
We are pleased to say that out of the conditions that the European Union wanted us to fulfill, only 2 were the ones that were critical, which they put at level 1 and level 2. And these were that we were not maintaining properly our aircraft. And we agreed that that was the position, because what they look at is whether you are following up at the manual all the maintenance records and following them to maintain them as and when it is required. If you don't do what you're supposed to do, by a week or so, it's already a mistake or a fault. And that is where we faltered. So we are pleased that we have been given time to correct our mistakes. And then we'll go back and ask again the European Union to come and examine our records and our books so that they find them to be, you know, properly maintained. One thing that I can explain to you is that we have been using the old method, a manual method of, you know, keeping our records. So that is the other area that they say, no, we must computerize. So we are busy now organizing the computerization of the system. So it's not anything very unusual, not something that you can say Zimbabwe is the only one that is faltered. But it's only that there are conditions that have to be followed, and those ones we are correcting now.
But, Honorable Gumbo, is it profitable to run an airline?
Airlines are not profitable world over, and this is why you find that they are into alliances. If you look at it, most of the airlines are now not doing it alone. But there is Star Alliance, Sky What Alliance, and so forth and so on. It is because on their own, airlines are not profitable. But you see, there are benefits that flow from running an airline. You bring in people who want to come and invest. You bring in tourists into your country. So downstream, there are benefits for having an airline. But on their own, airlines are not profitable, and they're not only Zimbabwe. Even with the problems that we are facing in Zimbabwe, Air Zimbabwe is better off than other airlines that are running at the moment. It's only Air Zimbabwe has had problems because we have not been able to meet our salaries or wages, and that is our major drawback as an airline. Maybe because we've employed too many people, which is not in conformity with the number of planes that we have. But generally speaking, world over, airplane business is not profitable and is not meant to be profitable. It's only meant to break even and bring our people to do the things that I'm talking about.
That was Joram Gumbo, Zimbabwe's transport minister, speaking with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. A robotics competition has brought more than 250 students from Senegal and other West African countries to Dakar this week, where they will learn to build and compete with their creations. Sidi Undao, who is from Senegal but now teaches at the University of Nebraska, created the competition. Undao talked to Ricky Stryer about his motivations and why the competition is important to science and technology learning in the region.
Edition of the program started in 2015, and we had a competition in Dakar where we had about 40 students, and then in 2016 we have about 210 students, and this year we have about over 207 students in from other countries in, outside of Senegal as well. Now, the reason why we created the competition is to promote STEM education in the continent for sustainable development. We believe that in order for the continent to develop in a sustainable manner, we need to have many engineers and scientists to solve the societal needs of the continent. And one way to promote it, or at least to get the interest of the students, is through robotics competition, such as the Pan-African Robotics Competition.
What are the ages of the people who are competing? Are they teenagers? Are they in university? And what is the criteria for them to come compete in this robotics competition?
Okay, so the age range from middle school to high school. So we're talking about 11 years old to about 18 to 19 years old students. And we do have a website called parkrobotics.org, where teams can actually go ahead and register and apply for to have a spot on the competition. And that's how we did it for international teams. By that, I mean other African teams. For Senegalese team, we selected them based on students or teams who have participated in the past, as well as to diversify the number of teams as much as possible. So we went out to Dakar and looked at other regions and got new teams from there as well.
How does the competition work? And can you explain the theme Made in Africa a little bit more?
Okay, so how does it work? So the competition brings together students from high school and middle school to compete on a challenge, a robotic challenge, that's centered around a topic that's relevant to sustainable development of Africa. For example, last year, the team was powering agriculture. So the students devised robots and as well as the middle school and high school, they devised robots that could go in the agriculture field and pick products and so on. And all those design devices or systems that could promote or have a better agricultural system in Africa.
That was Sidi Undao, who is from Senegal but now teaches at the University of Nebraska. He's also founder of the robotics competition. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar, Senegal. That's it for this Wednesday, May 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryer, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer, Carl Sterling. I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good day.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, what does the future hold for Liberia? Who will lead the West African nation when President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf leaves office in October at the end of her second term? 2 million Liberians have registered to vote, and nearly half of those are women. What's at stake in Liberia? On the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.